Hello and welcome everyone to our podcast, Physics Education, A Female Gaze. I'm your host, Fabiana, and today for this episode, I am joined by an inspiring woman and physicist, medical physicist, who is here today to share her experiences in learning, teaching, and doing physics over the years. Maite, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm excited.
Maite, I have a first question for you, just to jump right in. A personal one, but let's see. Do you have a favorite physicist?
I don't think I have one favorite physicist. I have many favorite physicists. I'm not particularly good at favorite. I have multiple people who have inspired me over the years. To be honest, the only woman in physics I knew back then when I decided to study physics was probably Marie Curie. So there's not so many references. So I had a wonderful physics teacher in university the first year, and she was fantastic. She had an amazing way of explaining the most complicated physics topics. And then I had a very, very nice PhD colleague who was also kind of my supervisor, my direct supervisor during my PhD, who was also, someone very important in my physics journey.
That's inspiring to hear, because teachers, we know that, and I hear it a lot, teachers have such big influence on their students. There's
so many
people that say, I had one teacher that could be even in high school or in university somewhere along the way, where they say that one teacher, that was really the one that inspired me a lot.
Yes.
That is great to hear. Well, you teased it a little bit there. What was your own journey into physics? How did you end up there? Where did it start, this whole journey?
It may be not a very conventional start into physics, I must admit. I've always been a very curious person by nature. I've always wanted to understand the why of everything around me. Mm-hmm. And there were movies, I love movies. And there were two movies that were really, I think, important in my beginnings into the physics world. One was Contact with Judy Foster. I don't know if you know. These are movies from the 90s. So wow. I would definitely recommend you watching them.
Or Ghost on the List.
Twister with Helen Hunt. And I remember I was very impressed always by the fact that, of course, so I'm not going to talk about the movies, but in both movies, there is scientists that research something. So Twister is about the storms and so it's the scientist that crazily goes after storms and wants to understand, and and Contact is about listening to some different sounds from space and making an understanding out of them. And in both cases, in both movies, it was interesting that also it was always the research was led by women. So I think that fascinated me because it was probably not common. But anyway, back then, when I was watching those movies, I didn't even know they were physicists. So I would always ask my mom, what do you need to study to be like them? And my mom would always answer physics.
Wow.
And I think that really, it really stick to me, because if I have to think about the origins of why did I end up into physics, I think my mom had a lot to do in that, no? By answering those questions with physics.
And telling you that.
Exactly.
How old were you when you watched those movies, when it really started?
I think I was probably 14 or 15 years old by then.
Teenager.
Absolute teenager. And it's interesting, I was particularly interested by astrophysics, by the space. I think it's maybe this romantic perspective, right? Or view of what physics can look like and really understanding the unknown. So I really wanted to be an astrophysicist. That's when I kind of decided.
That's when it happened. It's funny that you say it's an unconventional story, because most of the women I've talked to in this project start exactly like that. Most of them say, well, it was actually quite a coincidence. It was actually rather unconventional. So I'm starting to doubt whether there is such a thing as a conventional way into physics.
Probably not.
Probably not. So you say astrophysics was really what sparked you, but you ended up in a slightly different field, right?
Yes, in a completely different field.
How did that happen? Tell us a little.
So when I was in university, I remember I had my first, so I did the physics diploma in mm-hmm. Spain. So it was a 5-year studies and mm-hmm. it was general physics, but very focused on theoretical physics.
Okay.
So the first time I had contact and or the option to do astrophysics lecture was, I think, in my third year or so.
Mm-hmm.
And oh my gosh, it was the most boring class I ever had. Like, I cannot even start to explain. I think maybe by then I had stopped romanticizing astrophysics mm. and I realized it was a very abstract subject, right? I mean, it's a lot of mathematics.
It is.
And I'm also naturally a very social person. Mm-hmm. So I think I was missing a little bit that people aspect of this line of physics, right?
But you found it elsewhere, the people.
Yes. Side. Yes, that's correct. That's correct. So, well, after that first lecture, I realized, okay, astrophysics is not going to be my thing. That's clear. But of course, I mean, I still loved physics and I was very sure and certain that I wanted to continue into physics. I think mm-hmm. it was also because one of the reasons why I chose to study physics was a little bit to defy this status quo, and I wanted to be a girl, but also study physics, which was back then probably less common than today, but maybe still not common. So I had several very good teachers. I have one that brought us to the hospital to mm-hmm. see how physicists were working in the hospital.
Yeah.
And so that's when the first time I had contact with the medical physics world, something I didn't know anything about before. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know there were physicists in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And then we did a trip to the European synchrotron in France. And that's where I realized, wow, I would love to work on a topic that is really applied to humans. But at the same time, somehow I was very fascinated by technology and big machines. So the synchrotron was kind of the perfect place. Yes. And so the combination, I think, of those two visits was what made me also more interested into the field of medical physics, which is where I'm right now.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's a very interesting journey. would you say you found in that social aspect that you say you wanted more, the application, the human side of it?
Yes, absolutely. I think for me, it's always been very important to feel that what I do matters and helps, so mm-hmm. that it helps at a human level. And I think the hospital is a very clear example of that.
Yeah.
So, and it's not to say, I mean, there is a thousand other lines of physics that
of course
also help at the human level, absolutely. But somehow, maybe it's also randomly that's what I saw, because this teacher brought us there and that fascinated me. Probably maybe mm-hmm. another trip would have fascinated me as well. But yeah, I really think that going away a little bit of this very heavy theory and into the practicality or the application of physics mm-hmm. into something that you need for everyday life, that yeah. was something that was clearly more exciting to me. Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense, because it's also defying in a way that stereotype of the lonely genius that just sits in their own chamber and like writes down their theoretical calculations, and then suddenly there's a Nobel Prize at the end.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So physics really is a lot more than that. And you found by means of a great teacher, it sounds like, an inspiring person that brought you on a field trip.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's amazing. As a doctor, you just mentioned your PhD. As a doctoral researcher, you had responsibilities not just within your own research project, but you also were teaching, right?
Yeah.
That goes hand in hand here. What was the extent of that? What did you teach? What contexts? What content?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, I did the PhD. It was in a collaboration. So I was doing the experiments in the European synchrotron in mm-hmm. France, but I actually was part of the biomedical chair in the TUM in Munich.
Mm-hmm.
And my PhD topic was focused on X-ray imaging for biomedical applications.
Okay.
So as part of that journey, I had to also give some seminars to some of the students. So I did the seminar that was in modern X-ray physics.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very general. So actually, mm-hmm. it was an elective for physics students that were, I think, in their third or fourth year of studies.
So fairly advanced.
Yeah.
Quite the beginning.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. And in this seminar, we offered the students a list of 10 to 15 scientific articles and or publications, and then they had to choose one. So all those articles were, of course, selected by us, and it was all focused on the different topics within the biomedical physics field. And then so the students had to have a look at that list, read those articles, and then select one of them and basically work on that topic during the seminar, and then prepare a presentation and dissertation about the the paper and about the research of that paper. And there were several aspects evaluated, of course, on the soft skills part, you know, summarizing complex topics, etc. But also, on the other hand, it was also, I think, a way for us to help students get closer to research and to understand, you know, how or what research looks like and what type of topics exist, right? Because when you're a third year student, you don't really know the variety of, of topics that you can research on, right? So it was also a way.
Your own story, you were just saying that it wasn't until the third year that you had your first astrophysics decided, no, that's boring.
Exactly.
And then later went into something completely different.
Exactly.
So that's about when you start becoming a little more autonomous, maybe, in like picking the research topics and learning more about the different subspecialties. So that sounds like a rather small class, so not like the big 600 student lecture setup.
No, we were, I think we had around 15 students. More or less.
That's a good group size, though, right?
It was fantastic. It was also for me very nice as a first introduction into teaching. I mean, I've done a lot of teaching afterwards, but not in the academic environment so much. I think it was also the first time that I was no longer the student, but the teacher, right? So, of course, there is insecurities that come with it. And so,
Did you feel prepared for that teaching experience?
Did I feel prepared?
I think, did you have any seminars or like anything that would help you assuming that role that, as you said, was new to you, right? You came as a student yourself and then suddenly you were there in front of a class. How did that work out for you?
So I did not have any additional material for me to prepare besides what my team was doing in previous seminars. So in previous years for the same seminar, I had a lot of support from the postdoc I mentioned before, so from this woman that was super supportive and a big inspiration for me. But in fact, it was interesting. So I think I felt insecure in the beginning because, of course, I don't know, I had the feeling, okay, I'm doing something new. What if I'm not doing it correctly? Why? What if they don't like it? Or if they, because I think a big part or a big component of these seminars is also to make physics attractive. To these students that are used to these big lectures, as you mentioned, right, that are more heavy. And so I was, for me, it was important that they would take out something valuable for them. And so I was certainly insecure in the beginning, but I think I had a lot of support from this postdoc and from many other colleagues as well, in that, you know, you just had to be honest when they ask you a question you didn't know, you would look at it and then answer later. Like, I think you always had this fear that you are not able to answer a certain question, right? And then, and therefore, in my mind, it's always linked to, oh, I'm not good enough, right? Like this link. Yeah, and I think after that, I realized that I was certainly more than capable of leading these students through this seminar, yes.
That's an incredibly valuable learning that you mentioned right there. You say there's a link of, I don't know the answer to a certain question, so you think I'm not good enough. Where is that link coming from?
To be honest, I don't know. I think I'm not 100% sure if this is only happening in physics or if it's linked to academia in general. Like this idea that the best is the one who knows most, and therefore not having the answer to certain questions is linked to not being like as good as others who would know that answer. But yeah, I think that's probably where it comes from.
Is it something you felt previously unrelated to the teaching, to your physics performance, or came it up? Did it come up for the first time in the teaching part?
No, I think that came before. I think that during my studying physics, that was a big fear. Always, I always had the fear of not being good enough. Definitely. It's also, I guess, because I'm a woman, I don't know, and maybe that accentuates this feeling even more, right? But
well, yeah, you said before, when we talked about your years of studies, you said you knew that you wanted to study physics, but you also actively wanted to defy that being a girl. So you were aware of a tension here?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When I decided to study physics, I remember I had this psychologist in the high school, mm-hmm. that was kind of advising us on the selection of what we were going to study, mm-hmm. and the choice, sorry. And this person told me, and my colleague, actually, we were two from my class that were studying physics. I think we were the only two in the entire school. and then he said, as you know, in physics, in this university where you will go, every year 100 start and only 3 finish.
Wow.
So that was his advisory comment, right? And I will never forget that moment. And I think that probably triggered the beginning of this link between, you know, I don't know the answer, I'm not good enough. Because that the very first thing that was I was told when I said I wanted to study physics from this academic advisor was that.
I was like, are you sure? Yes. Are you going to be one of the 3 that make it out of 100?
Exactly. Sort of the Whereas here. I think I was very lucky to have family that were absolutely on the opposite side of how to approach this, rather encouraging and, you know, very supportive and never having any doubts that I was more than capable and that I shouldn't pay attention to those comments, right?
That's an important factor, that supportive network around to finish through. Wow. Do you feel like you were able later in your role as a teacher and potentially inspiring to others, younger students that come after you? Do you feel like you had opportunities to be that role to the next generation of young physicists?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I think I've grown out of that feeling, no? But of course sometimes it comes back. But I think I took it for me as a very important thing to do, to support the next generations that wanted to study physics. So I remember I had a student working with me at the end of my PhD. So I was also kind of advising a PhD student of first year, and also during these seminars, but also after. I've continuously been very open to any student or recently finished studies person, and particularly women always tend to contact me more than men, right? To really motivate. It's funny because I've been approached so many times to ask me about my experience, and I'm always super enthusiastic, like, yes, of course you can. Like, why wouldn't you be able to? Sometimes I wonder, these people might think that I'm just a bit crazy or crazy positive, or if they knew what I went through.
That's really, really important. Actually, we know that from research that this encouragement is a crucial success factor for being able to succeed in physics. It's something that we call self-efficacy from the psychological perspective. So your own belief in your competence, this, I think I can do it. And that directly correlates with your actual performance. So believing in yourself is not just, you know, in vain. It's not just words. It creates realities. So being positive and advising younger students, being like, yes, of course you can, is not shallow, and it's not without content. It really makes a difference.
And it's interesting that you explain this, because I truly believe that is really the fact that, you know, when you believe in your capabilities, you will be way more able to do it. But also, I think we are not told enough how capable we are.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's different when you feel it yourself or when somebody else tells you, right? Yeah. Like, oh, how wouldn't you be able to do this? Of course you are, right?
Yeah, that's the first step of it. Like that social persuasion is what the psychologists call it here. That is one of the main sources, especially for women, for feeling competent about themselves. Like that's mostly where that, not mostly, but to a large degree, where that feeling comes from. And actually, we also know from studies that the self-efficacy of women in physics tends to be a lot lower than men in physics. So they in, if we say simple words, women tend to not believe they can do it, whereas men are a lot more confident. They say, yeah, of course I can. Yes. And that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. Yes. So you're doing very important work in encouraging others.
Thank you.
If we go back to your teaching experience, that sounds like, honestly, from a teaching perspective, that sounds like a dream setup. You have a small class. You have motivated students that are a little further advanced. They can choose their own topics. It's very student-centered. How was that perceived by the students? How was the feedback that you got?
So what I do remember is that there was, as I said before, right, a big difference from one student to another. Mm-hmm. So I remember some of the students were very eager to contact me and mm-hmm. to work with me in certain mm-hmm. aspects. And I have mm-hmm. to say, most of the time, those were women.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, I guess you also try to find a relatable person, right? Yeah. So for girls studying physics, someone like me doing a PhD in physics was something more relatable to them. Mm-hmm. So that's for sure. And then I do know, for example, I had very good feedback from the student that I guided through the mm-hmm. PhD as well, right?
We're at that stage, you know, you're in your PhD, you're relatively new to teaching. Were gender-related questions a consideration for you? Was it something you were aware of, some tensions here, or did that only come a little later in your career?
So I think the gender topic has always been relevant in my decision and mm-hmm. in my physics journey, always. Mm-hmm. As I said before, I wanted to defy the status quo. And I wanted to also be a cool girl with social life and fun, but also studying physics and, you know, killing it in research and mm-hmm. and doing a PhD in a super amazing facility and super interesting topic and know a lot, mm-hmm. right? So I that's always been my thing, I have to say. I think back then, probably I wasn't that aware of how unconscious bias really affects every one of us, including yeah. us women, right?
Of course, we're not exempt from it.
Yeah, we are not. But it's very, very, it's been very present in all my years. So I was, when I was in the PhD, I mean, we were a big, big group and mm-hmm. I was in an office with six other guys. Mm-hmm. And I've had to listen to all sorts of very impolite comments that I always had to bear in a certain way, right? Like, mm-hmm. do I answer? Do I not? You know, like it's always, so that's maybe on a, more on a personal level, but on the basic level, I mean, there were almost no toilets for girls in the physics department.
Really?
I had to go downstairs and do a tour to go to a toilet. Right?
Wow.
And I was like, I mean, of course the building is old and all you want, but I mean, yes.
That was a hassle. So it's yes. that you make it sound like it was from the beginning very inextricably linked the two, the experience of being a woman and wanting to do physics.
Absolutely, yes. Yes.
And that evolved over the years. Like it started off from the beginning, but you also sound like you've grown a lot in that yeah. conflict, finding your identity, being both capable researcher and physicist and a woman.
Yes, absolutely. And still today, I mean, I'm still a physicist. I don't do research anymore, but yeah. still today, it's something that is very present. Also, it's interesting. I mean, probably it happened to you as well, but seeing the faces of the people around me when I told them what I was doing, like I will never forget that. That I have answers of all kinds.
Just for like example, disbelief or...
So what are you doing? Because, of course, I moved to Germany, but I'm mm-hmm. originally from Spain. So questions like, oh, so and what are you doing here? And I would say, well, I'm doing physics. And some people didn't fully understand. Like they wouldn't understand, like, what do you mean? And I was like, yeah, physics. Like, and some people would think it was gymnastics. for some reason. I don't know why. I was like, no, physics, like Einstein. And they would be like, oh wow. Like people were, I've had all sorts of comments. I must admit, maybe also I don't fulfill the stereotypes of physicists, which
who
I guess,
that?
Well, I wouldn't, I guess, I'm, as I said before, I'm a very social person.
Mm-hmm.
I love going out. I love being out with friends. I love, and I think the stereotype is that physicists are lonely people that like to be in the basement studying, mm-hmm. right?
The nerd is the nerd. The stereotype here.
I guess, yes, I guess.
Yeah, that's, I know what you mean. There's always funny ones. Although the gymnastics is a new one. I haven't heard that.
This is a conversation I had a lot with my today husband, back then boyfriend, mm-hmm. because he's an engineer and he was also in the same university. And all his friends, when the first time they would meet me, they would put all sorts of faces. And at some point I would be like, pissed. Like, I would be like, what do you expect me to be doing? Like, why is this so surprising? Like, why is this so surprising, right? Like, what of all the combination is so surprising? Like,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
What is it?
What is it?
It's also interesting that you said, just in a half sentence here, I am still a physicist, even though you don't do research anymore. That is an identity. You self-identified here and said, I'm a physicist. Now, that is a really interesting assertion that we've seen takes a long time for young women, especially girls, to develop this physics identity, to say about themselves, I'm a physicist, or I want to be a physicist. Can you remember back, like, how was that for you? Did you identify from the beginning as, oh, I will be a physicist, I am a physicist? Or did it take a little while to get to that comfort in having this identity?
I think it took a lot of work. I think it's also, we feel it's not our, or I mean, we, it's a generalization, right? But I think mm-hmm. we tend, as women, tend to feel it's not our place, but that, of course, if I'm the single person, a girl in an office of eight,
mm-hmm.
it's somehow you feel maybe you belong less there than others,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's interesting because I was thinking about now when we were talking about the seminars, something I realized over those years was that women were, or the girls that I was teaching were generally way better prepared in many other aspects related to this education, not only on the content. They had very developed social skills or communication skills, how to summarize content, like all mm-hmm. these additional skills that are so important, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas boys, not necessarily. And this, again, is a generalization, and I had very few, like 15 students. So it's,
yeah.
again, take it
just
with,
your you personal know, experience.
My experience. Mm-hmm. But then I realized that, of course, and both girls and boys were equally capable of understanding very complicated technical topics or like mm-hmm. heavy content, right?
Yeah.
And then I think this is an reflection that I've done later with the years, but I think for a girl to be studying third or fourth year of physics, what that girl must have gone through and proved to the world to mm-hmm. be there is mm-hmm. so different to what a boy must have gone through and proved, that they have to excel in so many other aspects. They mm-hmm. have to not only learn and understand the quantum physics very well, but they also need to be able to prove the rest of the world that they yeah. can, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was something that I've thought about, because it's also happening in other aspects. So not only mm. in the physics world, right? But mm. today at work, I totally see that. That I always, something that crosses my mind always is, well, they are both, if a girl and a boy are equally, you know, doing a great job, but what did she need to go through to be here today?
Yeah.
To be having this conversation about a very deep physical topic mm-hmm. related to a machine, right?
So. Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting thought. I haven't thought about it that way. There's a lot of what you said about the teaching and how you perceive your learners. A lot of that is something we know from research as well, and then we can back up with studies. But I haven't thought about that correlation of the other surrounding skills that you need to develop to get to this point in the first place.
Yes, I think it's something, I mean, and as I said, it's not a scientific comment, but rather really a feeling that I'm like,
yeah.
we have to become so much better in some aspects so that we can actually prove that we're smart enough to be physicists, right? So
that's a key sentence that you said right there. Like, we have to prove that we're smart enough to be physicists.
Exactly.
Wow. Yeah. And then we're back at believing in yourself that you can be smart enough.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh boy, there's so much to unpack here. It's I think also actually very enriching that you have a couple of years distance between your experience in university, your PhD and the teaching part, and now for that reflection time that it gives you that you just mentioned. So with this in mind, if you look back on those years of your own studying and of your teaching now, is there anything that you would do differently today?
I actually don't think so. No, maybe because there were moments where, I don't know, as I said, I'm very social and I'm also very outspoken. Mm-hmm. So when I felt something was unjust, I would very clearly say it. And mm-hmm. I know that has probably made me look not so nice sometimes, if to put it that way, yeah. And I think sometimes I regretted saying certain things that maybe I shouldn't have back then when they happened. And today with perspective, I'm like, no, actually, we need to keep saying when things are unjust mm-hmm. for us. And only that way we will be able mm-hmm. to continue to have parity also in physics and to make, because it's not about like, we need to be 50-50. It's more about women need to feel completely free and entitled to study physics because mm-hmm. it's super interesting, a super nice subject, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. self-doubt should not stop us from learning, right?
Do you have any examples of such experience when you were outspoken, when you noticed something was unjust?
Well, about the toilets. I made a fuss out of it, for example.
Really? You did?
Yes, of course. And then they told me, no, the building is old. We can't do much. And I was like, are you kidding me? I mean, seriously, what is this?
But you spoke up about it.
Yes. And I would always say, speak up. And I know this might be sometimes taken as aggressive, but I think that it's not aggressive. It's just showing the world that there is things that should change and also
you
it's
were perceived as like aggressive and just annoying to everyone
to the point that some of my colleagues wouldn't tell me. There were colleagues, so I made very good friends during my PhD, people that I love, men that I love to hang out with and whom with I disagree in so many topics, so
that's
also yes, but I think I've done a lot of teaching in that environment, teaching in for free. So what I mean by this is when a comment was disrespectful, I would very clearly state that the comment was disrespectful. And then maybe some of my friends decided to stop telling me certain things.
And that really happened? You see a change in the behavior?
Yes.
To a degree.
So yes, to a certain degree, I think yes. Yes. Because I'm not scared of conflict. Mm-hmm. Maybe they were, so.
But you didn't run away from it and no. You faced it.
Yes.
Wow, that requires a lot of courage. Speak out about it and face it. But I'm very glad you did. For everyone coming after us.
Yes. And I keep doing. I did and I keep doing.
Wonderful. Well, I know that we're almost at time here for our meeting. So I want to look a little bit into the future here with the last couple of minutes. Yes. So you look back and you said, no, you stand by what you did and you stand by being outspoken, even if it was difficult in the past. How do you look into the future? What would you change if you had a magical wand at hand?
I think it's also a very difficult question. I don't know if I would change something in the world that, you know, like physical change but what I think I wish is that we start to feel equally entitled to success mm-hmm. and to opportunity as men do in physics. So now we are talking about mm-hmm. the physics, right? Yeah. Really yeah. feel equally entitled to the success mm-hmm. because I think often we stop ourselves because we don't feel entitled to it. And that our gender doesn't interfere or define our dreams, that it should be the opposite, right? What do you like? Then go for it, regardless. That's what I hope. And that's what I wish also for my daughter. So whatever she wants to do, I mean, now we are talking about physics, but of course, whatever she wants to do.
It just goes into the bigger puzzle, of course.
Yes, makes sense.
Well, the big question is, how do we get there? If this is our desired future, we want a world where every woman feels empowered to follow her dreams and does not have to work triple as hard to get to the same point. The next question is, how do we get there? Do we have like a piece of advice for your daughter to help create that world?
Well, I think that we have to do it together. I think that the key aspect of this is that this is not only woman fighting or, you know, like, I think this is something that needs to come from the together word. And this is also why I said, like, I have a lot of good friends with whom I've had very lengthy conversations about these topics. Mm-hmm. Because I care, because I know these are wonderful men, and because I truly believe that if they would have been in my shoes, they would think like me, right? But they don't, because they haven't been in my shoes. So I think that this exchange is super important to show everyone that this is really a problem for all.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're here for, right? Like this, put yourself in my shoes. And that's what I called in the project, the female gaze, right? Like, look at this context, look at the setup, this topic through the lens of the female and think about what this experience is and how the very same subject can be experienced so differently with this lens. Well, Maite, this was a pleasure talking to you and hearing about your experience. I'm hoping that it was as inspiring to our younger listeners, other listeners, as it was to me. And I thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.